contemporary athlete has, as a tool of his trade, a device as fearsome and wondrous as today's racing car. Depending one upon the other, man and machine have forged records of every sort, won admiration the world over, grown steadily in sophistication and ability, all the while forcing each other to astounding achievements. During some years, one or the other seems to dominate. Fearless Freddie Lorenzen stockpiling super speedway victories in a memorable 1966 season. The thrilling perfection of Jim Hall's early Chaparral. Mario Andretti's effortless sweep of the 1966 USAC Championship. The Ford Mark II carrying America's challenge to Europe and burying Ferrari in a three-abreast triumph at Le Mans. But in 1967, the checkered flag symbolized triumph equally for car and driver. It was the year when both reached new stages of sophistication and refinement. It was the year when the thundering, dreadful machines and their brilliant drivers fused perfectly with each other, vaulting auto racing to splendid new heights of achievement.
Racing highlights of 1967, narrated by Chris Economaki, another Speed Sports special, brought to you by the Consumer Products Division of DuPont, makers of easy-to-use Lucite paint, the Work Skipper, DuPont hairbrush and comb sets, and Golden 7 oil treatment, the choice of champions.
Combination quickens America's pulse quite as much as the open-wheeled 1,350-pound, 170-miles-an-hour championship cars and the ice-nerved men who drive them. And while 1967 was a year of refinement for most types of racing, it was that and more for the United States Auto Club. The dirt tracks of old began to give way to road circuits. And with them came an influx of internationally rated sports car and Formula One drivers. Almost lost in the furor of change, A.J. Foyt and Mario Andretti battled to the wire in the most hotly contested championship in USAC's history. Perhaps the most memorable event occurred in Indianapolis, where Parnelli Jones and the revolutionary Turbin handed the race to Foyt when a $6 part broke three laps from the end. Parnelli, your career has seen you behind the wheel of almost every kind of racing car imaginable. What is your opinion of the Turbin as a racing car?
Well, I think it is really something that's going to come about in the future, whether we're ready to accept it or not. And more, it'll come first in commercial use, like trucks and boats and things of that sort. But the engine, pound for pound of metal, is just more practical than a piston displacement. And I think it has a great future of developing more horsepower and being more and more developed. So I think that we should not throw it out of competition.
And as the championship trail reached Langhorne after Indianapolis, it became evident that the Turbin car would not be a factor in the races on the one-mile track. The Turbin was designed for one track, Indianapolis. It would not appear again in 1967, but it blasted USAC into broiling controversy. By Langhorne, A.J. Foyt led the championship standings, his third victory in Indianapolis alone worth 1,000 points. Although defending champ Mario Andretti was not yet in the first 10, the season was young, and the fans could expect him to make a supreme effort for an unprecedented third straight USAC crown. Flag, Lloyd Ruby, in an untested Lotus, jumped into the lead. Al Unser, who took pre-race honors at Langhorne by establishing a world record for a one-mile track, shot past out of turn two and led for most of the 100 miles. Foyt wasn't competitive at Langhorne. Andretti, however, showed championship form, climbing from sixth to third, passing Roger McCluskey near the midway mark. The 100-miler was a surprisingly safe race. Only one yellow flag came out when Arnie Knepper and Johnny Rutherford collided. Six laps under caution for cleanup closed the field, and when yellow changed to green, leader Unser found himself in heavy traffic. Ruby in car number 25, seeing Unser boxed in, found another groove high on the turn and skirted wide, leaving Unser hopelessly behind. From that point on, there was no catching the burly Texan. Ruby raced to the checkered flag in record time, averaging better than 113 miles an hour.
And so another Langhorne 100 is history. Lloyd Ruby in car number 25, the winner. Al Unser, who set a new record in qualifying at number 5, was second. The national champion, Mario Andretti, last year's winner of this race, was third. As the fans rush across the track to congratulate Victor Lloyd Ruby, that's the end of another hot day at Langhorne.
By September, the championship cars had tasted the dirt and asphalt of many ovals and road courses. The Hoosier 100 at the Indianapolis Fairgrounds was one of four remaining dirt track races on the USAC calendar. Three dirt races were won by Foyt, whose victories totaled four, including Indianapolis. Andretti had more wins, but still trailed the Texan in the standings. Mario led from lap 15, and the best Foyt could do was finish second, 11 seconds back. Andretti's victory in the upright offie brought him within 60 points of Foyt. With five races remaining, the championship outcome was anyone's guess. A carnival atmosphere greeted USAC 2 weeks later in New Jersey for the Trenton 200. Andretti and Foyt shared the front row. The 400 points awaiting the winner dangled as a succulent prize. Andretti led from the start, shadowed closely by Foyt and Lloyd Ruby. On lap 5, Ruby made a play for the lead and tangled with Andretti, sidelining both cars. Foyt deliberately spun to avoid a collision, and he dropped to last place. AJ staged a brilliant comeback, avoiding four more accidents and surged into the lead with 30-odd laps to go when a failing Magneto finished the race for leader Al Unser. Average speed for the race was slow, as 50 miles were run under caution. Foyt's triumph gave him a substantial lead over Andretti, but they later exchanged victories at Sacramento and Phoenix, so the gap narrowed again.
And the scene shifts to Riverside, California, for the last big race of the year. The Rex Mays 300 will decide the USAC national champion. A.J. Foyt, Mario Andretti, and Gordon Johncock in contention.
Once the action started, all eyes were on leaders Dan Gurney and Grand Prix import Jimmy Clark. Riverside continued the road course challenge of left and right turns and brake-burning gear changes for the circle-oriented championship cars. Gurney led the initial stages till he locked brakes at turn 6 and skidded onto the dirt infield. Clark moved smoothly to the point with Dan in pursuit. Back in fourth, Andretti had to win the race with A.J. finishing no higher than 6th if he was to take the championship. Clark led for just one lap before a blown engine sidelined the Wee Scott. Behind Gurney now, Bobby Unser, Roger McCluskey, Andretti, and Foyt. With less than half the race completed, Foyt collided with Al Miller's spinning racer. A DNF would cost A.J. the USAC championship if Andretti finished no lower than 4th. That's just where Mario was running at the time. But Foyt had other plans. He abandoned his car and sprinted for the pits. Roger McCluskey had moved into 2nd, and at turn 9, passed a faltering Dan Gurney to take the lead. To assure Foyt the championship, three backup drives were arranged in the event he encountered bad luck. McCluskey was one of those who volunteered to turn over his ride. Foyt's own backup car, driven by Jim Herdebees, was at the moment being garaged with an oil leak, so the decision was made to bring McCluskey in. Foyt would get only a percentage of the points awarded the McCluskey car, and the pitside mathematicians were busy figuring the finish position Foyt would need to give him the championship. If Andretti won, it wouldn't matter, but at the moment, Mario was in 4th. The driver change coincided with fuel stops. Andretti had an adjoining pit, and the drama of that moment made it seem eons longer than the 12 seconds it all took. Later, fate stepped in again. Leader Gurney needed a tire change.
Boyd had dropped to fifth, repitting to tighten a fuel cap. So the lead went to Andretti, who had inherited second when Bobby Unser stopped for gas. Gurney was reshot in 26 seconds and went out in third, a half a lap back with a big minute and 5 seconds to make up. It seems unlikely he would catch Andretti and Unser. Foyt in fifth was experiencing trouble with the McCluskey Eagle, but had a lap on the sixth place car. Then it happened. Unbelievably, with 4 laps remaining, Andretti pitted for gas. The tarred pace and the fuel demands of the engine had burned away Andretti's bid for the crown. In a spectacular drive, Gurney had whittled his deficit to 13 seconds. Andretti pulled out in third. Behind Gurney and the new leader was Unser. Mario was half a lap back and time was running out. One lap remained. Gurney went deep into turn 9, daringly inside of Unser, who, caught unaware, couldn't cut off Gurney's play for the lead. This move climaxed a brilliant display of driving by the native Californian, who overcame his usual bad luck syndrome. Andretti was too far back to improve his third place position, and that wouldn't be enough if Foyt could hold on to fifth. Gurney's Olsenite Eagle averaged better than 108 miles an hour, bringing him home 4 scant seconds ahead of Bobby Unser. It's been said that Riverside is Dan Gurney's track. No one could dispute that the initial Rex Mays 300 was also all his. Andretti finished 81 points short of the USAC championship, an unprecedented fifth for Foyt, although he needed help in the process.
McCluskey, which drives for Lindsey Hoskins, for the race told me in case I need his car that I could use it, and at the time I got in, he was leading the race, so I owe all the championship to, actually, Roger McCluskey.
A great sporting gesture, don't you think?
Sure is. We've been friends for many years, and I'd done the same thing for him. I think that's the reason he did it for me.
Thus, USAC ended a year whose outcome more than fulfilled its promise.
Did you do it, buddy?
Coming up, more of the same from the sports car scene.
Chris Economaki here at the Daytona International Speedway. You know, automobiles and automobile racing have been my business for 30 years. And I want to tell you, if top performance is what you want from your car, what you want is DuPont Golden 7, the high-performance motor oil additive. Take the men who race cars for a living. They know what Golden 7 can do because they depend on getting top power and performance from their cars. You'll know it, too, when you add DuPont Golden 7 to your motor oil. Golden 7 does 7 things to give you top performance. It stops excess oil burning, boosts compression, boosts horsepower, quiets the engine, protects all working parts, cuts engine wear, cuts engine repairs. That's it. If you want top performance from your car, get DuPont Golden 7, the high-performance motor oil additive.
Perhaps the most perfect rapport between car and driver in 1967 was exhibited on the circuits across the United States and Canada where the big sports racers competed. These 1,300-pound speedsters, sporting better than 400 horsepower, were nearing the 200-mile-an-hour mark before season's end. And the men who drove them, first in the U.S. Road Racing Championship and then the Canadian-American Challenge Cup Series, also reached new summits of achievement. First, it was the slashing blue of Mark Donahue's Chevy-powered Lola, devastating the competition in the USRRC. Then the vibrant orange McLarens of Bruce McLaren and Denny Holm, making a shambles of the Can-Am Series. In each case, the championship was decided by a series of races. In each case, the driver-car combination was a perfect match.
We're going to run just as hard as we have to win. If that means running flat out the whole race, our car can do it, and we're prepared to do it.
By the time the fifth U.S. Road Racing Championship event at Watkins Glen, New York, was flagged off, Donahue had proved his point by becoming a victory lane regular. In the previous 4 races, Mark had scored 3 firsts and 1 third over the likes of Lothar Motschenbacher, Sam Posey, Peter Revson, and Chuck Parsons. At the Glen, Donahue was again first on the grid, first away and first at the end. His victory was echoed twice more before season's end, giving Donahue 6 triumphs in the 7 races he started in the 1967 U.S. Road Racing Championship. The Canadian-American Challenge Cup followed on the heels of the USRRC. Top racing stars the world over gathered at Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin to initiate the $500,000 series. They were greeted with a surprise.
I think Bruce McLaren surprised us and just about everybody with this car. He, as they say, sort of caught us napping a little bit.
McLarens are turning some real fast times, and boy, it looks like there's really some competition here.
McLaren's flower power, a fuel-injected Chevy engine, and wide, wide tires were surrounded by a sanitary chassis and body representing months of effort and 2,000 miles of testing. Bruce planned to revenge last year's dismal showing. Most of the other cars were only modified versions of last year's models. Except for the Holman Moody Honker, Ford powered and Ford sponsored. Mario Andretti worked long and hard, but mechanical problems sidelined him before the race and for most of the series thereafter. At the outset, the amazing McLaren seemed the target.
All the locals have had to go a lot harder than what they ever thought they were going to go, and I think we stole the march on them. At least for this meeting, anyway. We don't know the results because the race hasn't been run, but in practice, it looks like we're the hot favorites.
When they rushed down Road America's long pit straight to start the 200-mile race, it was Holman McLaren up front. New Zealander Holm quickly established his preference for the lead spot, McLaren just behind in second. Paul Chaparral was woefully inadequate to the job, even with the new 427 engine. He ran fourth most of the race. McLaren retired relatively early with an oil problem. Gurney was to follow suit with a variety of difficulties. Surtees and Donahue had an interesting duel for second place, which finally became Donahue's. Holm took the checker with ease, a commanding lead over second place Donahue. The opener was all Team McLaren. Bridgehampton was another Team McLaren win. Bruce this time finished second. Holm has an easy time winning.
Was it a difficult race for you, Denny?
No. After the first 10 laps, it became reasonably easy. I was dawdling for a little while and spun it, so I decided to go a bit quicker after that.
Round two to McLaren. But it wasn't so easy a week later at the Players 200 in Canada. Holm and McLaren qualified 1-2, but the field was waved off on the pace lap without McLaren. A fuel leak discovered at the last minute kept the team hopping. McLaren had to join at the rear of the pack, more than a minute down to the entire field. Holm quickly established himself in his customary position, and the likes of Gurney, Spence, Donahue, and Surtees were left to the now familiar game of chase the orange comet. McLaren, meantime, was doing some chasing of his own. In a dash-all style, long to be remembered, McLaren picked off the field with trap-shooter accuracy. Holm sat on the lead with effortless ease while his partner stormed up from the rear. Finally, as the laps began to run out on him, McLaren passed Gurney to take over second place behind Holm. But then Denny lost it at Moss Corner. The resultant flat, a severe handicap, but no time for a pit stop. To hold things together long enough to take the flag. McLaren roared by just seconds behind after starting dead last. Holm won, but McLaren's drive was historic.
This is the kind of a drive you turned in today, was the kind of a drive that motor racing writers will be writing about for years to come. What motivated it?
Well, basically, just being so far behind. Yeah, it's a nice way to race that. I think every racing driver likes the opportunity now and then to be able to come right from the back of the field. It's a great way. You just forget about anything going wrong with the car and just stand on it.
The Can-Am contingent moved next to Laguna Seca on California's beautiful Monterey Peninsula. The competition was sharpening its fangs. Dan Gurney finally got his Lola Ford working and was the first man to break the McLaren Holm grip on the grid.
We've changed our suspension around quite a bit, and we've done some testing at Riverside in the past weeks. and we have improved our car quite a bit.
As we go on through the series, I think that the rest of the competitors are getting closer to us.
It was the first time in the series that the front row was not all orange. But despite some early promise, Jones, Hall, and Donahue were still not able to stem the McLaren onslaught. Home had to quit with a blown engine on the 80th lap, and Bruce had no trouble holding the lead and lapping the entire field to bring Team McLaren another victory. Nevertheless, at Riverside for the Times Grand Prix 2 weeks later, the opposition showed no signs of handing the series to McLaren's juggernaut. Gurney grabbed the lead right off, with McLaren, Hall, and Farnelli Jones in pursuit. Through the buttonhook at Turn 8, Jones hit a tire marker, which then smacked Holmes' car. Gurney soon lost the lead and eventually retired. Farnelli Jones flew magnificently past Dan and Bruce to take first with his Lola powered by a Ford Indy engine. But McLaren was still in contention. Holmes' difficulties compounded. Refused entry to the track, he set a record for running backwards, only to have officials tell him he was out of the race because of the missing fender. Then Farnelli began to fade and dropped into a dogfight for third with Mark Donahue. McLaren rose to the occasion and battled Jim Hall in the chaparral the rest of the way for first place. They traded the lead four times during the remaining laps, with McLaren finally getting the job done at Turn 9 and holding on to the flag. Bruce led 48 of the 62 laps, setting lap records left and right. His second victory lane appearance, plus his earlier runner-up finishes, gave McLaren the series lead, 3 points ahead of home. Thus, when they wheeled the Can-Am Brutes out for the last go at Las Vegas Stardust International Raceway, the series had been decided. Either McLaren or Holm would win, depending on their finish. No one else was in contention. But the grid showed the diminishing McLaren preeminence as Hall held down the second spot next to pole sitter McLaren. Jones and Holm were on the third row. Flying start, Jones burst past everyone in a patented Farnelli start and grabbed the lead. There was every indication before the race that McLaren was in for a tough go.
His competition right now is making him mash in the gas a little harder.
Oh, yeah, he can be beaten. We're getting closer all the time, and maybe today will be the day.
And it began to look like it would. Home was slowed with a flat tire. McLaren retired with an engine spewing oil, leaving Holm to make a desperate effort to repass the entire field. Hall ended up with the lead, followed by Gurney and Donahue. Surtees, last year's series winner, worked his way up to fourth behind Donahue. Then Hall's engine let go, and Mark Donahue, who'd been driving the same steady series that brought him a second overall last year, was out front. Hall made a fantastic dash to the pack, finally passing Donahue to get back on the same lap with the leaders. Then his engine blew. Both McLarens were sidelined, but their drivers were reasonably happy with the first two championship positions assured. Then, to everyone's surprise, Donahue's included, he ran out of gas on the checker flag lap. Coasting down the pit straight, a disconsolate Donahue had to watch helplessly as Surtees caught up and flashed by to win the race. In victory lane, a surprised Surtees and jubilant McLaren shared the spotlight.
First of all, Bruce, the winner of the series, congratulations. It's very sporting of you to come down here to help present the trophy to John. What happened to your car?
Well, it blew. The engine blew. It blew a lot of oil and water out very early in the race. And the same thing happened to Dennis. Pretty hard way to win a series, but I'm really glad for John. He deserves it.
John, congratulations. Are you surprised?
Well, I was certainly surprised when I saw Mark, you know, sort of slowing around the last corner. But I've been in racing long enough now to know that, you know, no race is ever won until the flag's gone down.
Between them, McLaren and Holm took the flag on every race but one. One or the other was fastest qualifier for every race in the series, and the team walked off with $164,000 in prize and point money. Most of all, McLaren, Holm, and their cars bespoke the ultimate in car and driver refinement and rapport. Next, Dixie's contribution, the stock car and the super speedway. Names like Daytona, Atlanta, Darlington, and Rockingham mean fender-to-fender, bumper-to-bumper late-model stock car racing that originated in NASCAR's home ground, the Deep South. But traditionally, the big league opener comes in California at Riverside International Raceway in the shadow of the San Bernardino Mountains in the desert country. This year's Motor Trend 500 got off to a lopsided start. 50 laps were run before an unseasonal rain turned the dun brown Riverside Raceway into a glorious green. A week later, the cars and drivers came back. All in all, it's a mixed-up start for the 1967 stock car season. But then, most seasons start off this way. NASCAR's attempts at uniformity again touched off the annual rule squabble with Ford and Chrysler. Ford was allowed to run with dual carburetors, a rule viewed as a handicap by the drivers of the more powerful Dodges and Plymouths.
Well, it definitely is a handicap. We do use a little more fuel. One of the reasons being is our manifolding. We have one four-barrel carburetor. Against the Ford has dual four-barrel carburetors, and they can distribute their gas much better and evenly.
Well, it's always a handicap if you can't run as far as the other man, but it's just according to how the caution flags fall and how much faster you can run than they can or how much faster they can run you can. It's all goes back to who gets the most brakes.
It would be mid-season before the cars would be refined and equal, and the drivers confident that victory would depend only on the brakes. Meantime, there were races to be won. The Motor Trend 500 restarted in the pits for Fred Lorenzen. He required new rubber, but rules disallowed any repairs until the race was restarted. Richard Petty in a Plymouth was best prepared after the week-long layover and took the lead. Dan Gurney, four times winner of the event, was second in a Mercury. David Pearson in a Dodge, third. Paul Goldsmith, fourth in Plymouth. Pernelli Jones, a dusty fifth in a Ford Fairlane. Then Gurney stormed past Petty to take the lead. The road course demands on the stock class cars gradually whittled the field. Petty out, Pearson two. Lorenzen had reached second before retiring with a trail lead. But pell-mell Pernelli kept blasting away at the track and his opponents, finally assuming charge with 100 laps to go. Gurney had led briefly, but lost the lead in a caution flag mix-up and finally retired when his engine let go. Jones stormed home unpressed in the last laps for a convincing and hard-earned Motor Trend 500 triumph, the first big one for Ford. 3,000 miles across continent, the Stockers thundered away under bright skies for the second major confrontation of the season, the prestigious Daytona 500. Curtis Turner Chevelle grabbed the lead from the pole position. The biggest names in racing were there. Chrysler had Petty, Goldsmith, and Pearson. Ford had Lorenzen, Yarborough, and USAC greats Hoyt and Andretti. Petty started the procession that was eventually to see the lead swap 36 times among nine drivers. Leroy Yarborough and a Dodge Charger got into the act, too. It wasn't long before an oily track brought out the caution, and most of the top runners pitted. Andretti elected a bolder strategy and inherited first by staying on the track. When the green showed, Andretti was ready and sprinted to the front. Goldsmith and Buddy Baker made things interesting around turn three. Then Goldsmith lost it on the turn four banking. The followers narrowly missed, although Cale Yarborough damaged his front suspension as he hit the apron off the banking. The caution gave Andretti a desperately needed chance to refuel. As the race wore on, Lorenzen found himself running with Andretti. The other leaders long retired. When the green flag signaled the drag race, Andretti broke a two-car draft, smoking past Lorenzen and Tiny Lund. Lorenzen's Ford was set up for drafting like a car in overdrive. His strategy? To conserve fuel, make fewer pit stops, and in the final stages, ride it hard. Will the strategy pay off? Jack Sullivan, Lorenzen's chief mechanic.
Well, it's up to him and Mario. Boy, I don't know, I'll tell you. We've got our car set up just a little bit tighter than Mario's has for drafting, and it appears that Mario's is a little faster than ours.
Do you think that Freddie can draft him into that last corner of the race and beat him to the line?
I hope so. I think that's what he's working on. That's what he's depending on anyway.
Now, when he wanted to, Lorenzen couldn't take Tiny. Andretti opened it to 22 seconds. An oily track sent Jerry Grant and Jim Herdebees in a nose-down spin. No serious consequences except for Lorenzen. With a caution out and only two laps remaining, Andretti was guaranteed a first-place finish. As yet, no one had a clear-cut hold of the point standings. The NASCAR regulars had lost the first two big ones. More than 60,000 fans were gathered 2 months later for the Atlanta 500. Cale Yarborough in a Ford Fairlane grabbed the pole in a record-breaking time. When the early lap fireworks burned out, Cale prevailed, only to find Ford stablemate Mario Andretti in view. Andretti started 22nd, but made a fantastic rush through the field. The dauntless USAC star was racing on only 4 hours sleep after his victorious Sebring race the day before. The two Fairlane aces staged one of the most thrilling duels in Super Speedway history. Andretti slipped by, just out of turn four, but a brush with the wall forced him to relinquish his lead and finally retire. Yarborough vanquished some minor challenges and went on to his first Super Speedway title. In the races to follow, Petty picked up four victories and was second to James Hilton in the Grand National standing. The Chrysler-Ford battle had 10 wins for Chrysler and 5 for Ford, although Ford had more Super Speedway victories. Since the NASCAR Grand National Circuit was founded 18 years ago, there have been 801 races held. And these two men, between them, have won 108, 54 each, a record number. Lee, since you're now retired, the man most likely to break your record will be your son, Richard. Are your loyalties torn?
I really hope that he breaks the record today or near future and then go on and double our capacity we've already done.
Richard, because the record is your father's, do you have mixed emotions about going after it?
To go after the record is not my goal. The next thing to do is win the race, and if I happen to break the record on the way, then that's okay.
A deafening roar signaled the charge for the rebel flag at Darlington International Raceway. Before half the field got to the start line, a skirmish sidelined six cars in what looked like a union attack. David Pearson headed the leaders, followed by Buddy Baker and Richard Petty. Pearson, in his first major race for Ford, replaced all-time NASCAR money winner Freddie Lorenzen, who a few weeks before had announced his retirement. By the 13th go-around, Baker had edged by Pearson and Petty charged by two. Baker was also in a big car factory ride, driving a Dodge Charger for Ray Fox. Petty's Plymouth is actually a 1966 car with a 67 grille. The car was so well set up at season's end last year, the Petty's decided to run with it again. Three laps later, Rapid Richard showed the form that was to carry him to 27 victories in 49 Grand National races. From this point on, Petty led most of the 291 laps. The Rebel 400 launched a string of victories that paid the Randleman ace over $130,000. Baker tried to stay with Petty, but rammed Wendell Scott, who spun into the rail. Pearson made contact too, ripping his left front fender. They both raced a while, so Baker lost oil pressure and began to overheat. The accident cost Pearson a lap, but the surgeon in the pits cut away the damage, so Pearson raced on. Petty was in and out a few times for gas and tires, losing the lead and then winning it back. Pearson could never overcome the lap he lost in the pits. Twice he got in the same lap with the leader, but each time Petty passed him and regained the advantage. Engine temperatures boiled to 240 degrees and tire wear was obvious. Late in the race, Petty blew a tire and brushed the wall in turn one. The inner liner saved the day for the Blue Plymouth. This pit stop gave a lap to Pearson, but Petty still led. Armand Holly and Dick Johnson spun in the first turn to bring out the last of five caution flags. This one lasted nine laps as the turn was blanketed with oil and water. While the yellow flag waved, Petty took on more gas and a set of fresh tires. He buried Pearson again when the racing started and went on unchallenged for the first back-to-back Rebel win in NASCAR history. Petty's victory at Darlington was his seventh of the campaign. It marked a new all-time NASCAR record for career wins, 55. He added 20 more before the season ended, finishing 40 times in the top 10. All in all, it was a banner year for the Petty clan.
A big day for the company, for the car, and for you, Richard. 55 and a record-breaking career. Congratulations. Was it a tough one?
Well, it started off pretty tough, and Bomber and Buddy Baker and David Pearson had trouble, and they was my main competition, and they had a little bit of trouble. Of course, I blew a tire and ran into the wall, too, but they seemed to have a little bit more trouble than I did, and the car ran real good. So really, after we'd run, say, 100 miles, I felt like if nothing happened to the car, we'd